And I would like to call up Eileen Fraser to take over from Joe to moderate the session. Eileen Fraser is the Executive Director of CAMPS and the co-chair of the TRB ANB 10 EMS Safety Subcommittee.
Our next section, we probably could have done a whole day on new technologies and telematics that are out there since our 2009 session, but we're going to start off with dispatch technologies. Dr. Augustine?
Thank you. My name is Jim Augustine. I'm an emergency physician as well. I have had a variety of places of employment. Washington Township is in Ohio. I have served as medical director for DC Fire EMS and for Atlanta Fire. And with a variety of places that I have practiced, I've been in the system for some time, have noticed the difference in challenges in our communication systems. So a little bit of today is why and how we end up with vehicle safety issues coming about as a result of EMS. Dispatching systems operate from basic to cutting edge, and there's software and hardware issues. It relates directly to safe vehicle operations. There are community needs, demands, and attributes which heavily work into the challenges for the people that are in the streets. Public safety has been developing integrated systems, so these match across the needs in law enforcement, fire, and EMS. And that integration of reports across the variety of places that require reports from us. And a new cutting-edge challenge is getting instruction help to the caller. Public safety, again, brings together the disciplines, 911, law enforcement, fire EMS, EMA, in some cases, corrections, in some cases. And in many of the types of incidents that we have, all of three of them have to report safely, by the way, to the scene at the same time. In the smallest of centers, like the one that I work in Ohio, there's one person who's taking the call, one person who's dispatching the call, one person who's managing the call on the radio. And so 911 consists of an individual who's sitting there doing all of those things and making sure that all services get the backup in a timely manner that they require. Across the country, the count of public safety answering points is about 15,000, and the movement is towards integrating those, particularly at a county level. Public safety may be under emergency management or law enforcement, and there are natural conflicts, and it's been defined to me in the past, EMS and fire are dispatched at the point where the emergency is evolving. In many cases, law enforcement dispatch occurs after the emergency has already occurred. Why is the emergency system so busy? First of all, it is the system that allows sick people to go back home. And this is a very important trend to understand and a challenge to understand. In prior days, sick people used to stay at the hospital for long periods of time where they lived right adjacent to the hospital. With the advent of systems that allow us to take a lot more care to the home, those people can be sent out of the hospital. And now one of the ongoing challenges as an EMS medical director is how do we deal with all of the devices for infusion and breathing therapy? We have ventilators at home, trach devices, et cetera. So sick people go home, and this is the system that allows them to do that. As we evolve the system, just so you're aware, we have hospital-based care, we have community-based care, and where we operate is in the strata that you would call unscheduled care. And unscheduled care is in place in order to move people efficiently across the other two spectra of care. Regional accountable emergency systems will be required to have a capture point, and at that capture point, they will have to manage people through their medical needs. If it's something that can be managed very, very simply, we can do it by sending that resource to where they are. So there's a new challenge of getting the right vehicle, right place, right time, right resources at the right price that will come into effect even more so. If you could look at the heritage of emergency medical services, the heritage goes back to 1964, when in this city they designed the Medicare and then the Medicaid system, and as part of that, house calls were not covered. Therefore, the specialty of emergency medicine that I practice in and emergency medical services had to come into be because doctors used to go to people's houses to deliver their babies and to deliver medical care. And when the federal government said we're not going to pay for that, we had to develop systems of care then to bring them into the hospital where care could be received. We have also underappreciated the impact of burns and trauma and injury and cardiac arrest. If prevention works, then more people stay alive to get ill. I look at one system of care, which is Dayton, Ohio, that I've been in for many, many years. I used to run about 4 cardiac arrests a day, and now we run 1 a day. In Washington, D.C., serving as medical director, we run just a little over 1 cardiac arrest a day in Washington, D.C. In Atlanta, Georgia, we run 1 cardiac arrest a day in Atlanta, Georgia. If it's at the airport, is my success rate high or low? Very high, over 60%. If it is in the streets, you know, essentially in a home or a nursing home in Atlanta, Georgia, is that success rate high or low? It's very low. And that, my friends, is a success story, not a failure story. Okay? In 1979, when I first started in the field, dispatch out on a person down, it would oftentimes be a 50-year-old man in V-fib with a cardiac arrest that was amenable to defibrillation. We would then use at that point a suitcase-sized device unless we got one of our medics finally got the coolest piece of technology ever, which was the Physio-Control LifePak 5. Okay, and those of you old enough will remember that and what it went from this to something really cool. We would defibrillate those people, oftentimes get back a perfusing rhythm, take them to the hospital for state-of-the-art care. State-of-the-art care for sudden cardiac arrest and acute MI was 14 days of bed rest on heparin. Okay? So now we drop our cardiac arrest rate very dramatically, mostly because of prevention and the fact that 50-year-old men no longer do go down in VFib. Our cardiac arrest population now is very much older people with very much terminal illnesses whose presenting rhythm is asystole or PEA, which are fatal rhythms. And that is a success story. And my son, who's now a firefighter paramedic who gets dispatched out on calls, his chance of resuscitating people when he arrives in their home or nursing home and tries to resuscitate them should be very low. Okay, so that is a success story. It adds a lot of people back to the population. And we're surprised in our hospitals that we're short on telemetry beds. The use of services within a city is very predictable, and right now the CDC count on use of emergency medical services is about 415 uses of the emergency system per 1,000 population per year. EMS accounts for about 80 of those trips to the hospital, ambulatory about 335. Just so you're aware, these work across large population groups in the United States. In order to accommodate this, we have had to develop dispatching and communication systems that move these systems of care out into the public. We have small, simple operating centers, but progressively now we've consolidated those. And we have software makers that produce large integrated programs. They allow tiered levels of responses, and our ongoing challenge is fewer and fewer of those arrive on the enhanced 911, so we can't have automatic call locating. The challenge for the emergency medical service operator, as we would look at the data that is captured across a 911 call, first is what is your emergency, and that usually takes a fairly short period of time. Where is it? What is going on, and can we use you to help? So those are the four elements of a communication call at a PSAP or secondary answering point. As we get to fewer and fewer landline calls, and we still don't have technology that allows automatic phone locating, the purple bar there requires more and more time. Exactly where are you, or exactly where is the emergency? so that they can precisely dispatch equipment. What is going on should have been our biggest segment of the interview. And we have, again, software and professional systems that allow us to, as best as possible, determine what the level of emergency is so that we can send the response. But if we have an overall time requirement for the person to process a call, realize that locating the call becomes a higher and higher percentage of that. Ideal call tiering has the highest priority calls getting a pre-alert, then a dispatch and a full response. Medium priority calls would get a pre-alert and one or two vehicles responding. Low priority calls ideally would get one vehicle with a no lights or siren response. And a lowest priority call in a variety of circumstances we'll talk about get phone advice and referral to primary care. A fully integrated system has these elements, which are predictive algorithms up front to say how many vehicles we need at what locations, at what time in order to accommodate the predicted call load. Call taking and then computer-aided dispatching of the appropriate vehicles. Call management to move assistance directly to the call. The on-scene patient management occurs by the crews that are dispatched. They then have an important element of communication that talks about the patient they have to the hospital, or they use telemedicine approaches with things like EKG transmissions and other things. They consolidate all this into an electronic patient care report. It is quality assured, and the newer systems allow live online quality assurance. And then at the back end, integrated billing and reports, and the system learns more and is able to predict into the future better how they can respond. Reducing call layers, again, with the consolidation of many of these services down to like county-wide centers, they have computer-aided dispatch, vehicle locating, GPS instructions for the people who are responding. And even in a few systems, imagine this, they're going to an industrial setting where an explosion or an incident has occurred at a known hazard site. The caller has a lot of technical information, and the caller is put directly online with the responsible battalion chief or lead emergency responder. So imagine that we quit playing phone tag through the dispatcher and directly take the person who has the knowledge and put them in charge with the lead responder. If we erase boundaries, we reduce further the hazards, and we have seen a reduction in volunteer and if you will, respond from home forces that have been in place in this country. Private vehicle responses still have a lot of risk associated with them. Still dangerous is when public safety responders crash into each other. And fatal accidents occur when fire, law enforcement, and EMS vehicles are all responding, moving towards similar intersections fairly quickly, and we see crashes involving those pieces of equipment. As well, when we're standing there together, and this is my reminder always in my career, the responders out on the scene have to use their vehicles for protection, and if those vehicles don't protect them, somebody runs them over and two of them die together. Call management is so now we have a 911 call that has come in. Now we process that by our medical protocols. That's call taking, a medical interview, in some cases pre-arrival instructions, and then timely alerts. And a pre-alert system is where a 911 center will know that a call is coming in. It has an EMS component. And before they can collect all the information and do the medical interview, they pre-alert and begin to move an ambulance or an engine, fire engine, towards the scene. So a new element of this is a pre-alert. And then a tiered response occurs with a variety of agencies. And in some cases, in many jurisdictions across the country, a police officer is dispatched to an EMS call at the same time that the ambulances are. At the medical transport level, our challenge is to get the right facility that is not on diversion. And in many of our metropolitan area, getting the information about what hospitals are on diversion is very important information, and the crew on scene can't make a determination about where they're going to transport until they have received clearance that they can take a patient to a certain hospital. Our medical transport system has to be surge capable. We're looking at reducing emergency transports because emergency transports, lights, and siren put more people in jeopardy, the transport crew, the patient, as well as motorists and others who are on the street trying to move around those vehicles. And then our object here is, again, providing safe transport. Current challenges. In Naples, Florida, where I live right now, we have a very elegant system for tiering calls. And we start off with, is the person alert, and are they breathing, and do they have a pulse, et cetera. A large percentage of our calls are from elderly call takers who are fortunate enough to be living at home. The information that they have is very simple. He's sick. You can ask as many questions as you want to. He's sick. Is he breathing? He's sick. Does he have a pulse? He's sick. In Atlanta, Georgia, a lot of our calls are person fell out. And no matter how many questions you ask, the person fell out. There are many third-person calls. I don't know. She said she's ill. And so we can go through all this tiering that we want to, but for a variety of reasons, we can't gather any further information. And in a large percentage of calls, then we have to assume the worst in those circumstances and have to assign a larger level of response than ideal if we could interview the patient and get a great deal of information. Many of you are aware that years ago in Dallas, Texas, there was a famous case where they're trying to triage their calls and hone down the number of calls. There's only one thing that is absolute in this industry. The incident that you assign the least response to is the one that's going to turn into the major one. And so the community expects high levels of response from us, and we cannot afford to under-respond to incidents. 911 calls are in the public domain.
Dr. Augustine, we have a one-minute wrap-up warning here. Yes.
911 calls are in the public domain. They need to be privileged and confidential. Instead, they're part of the public domain. Call locating is very challenging. As yet, we can't use text, SMS, or Twitter to contact 911 centers. Our newest challenges are for a class of calls called Lyft Assists. And the key question there is really how big, so how many people do we need to assign to that? Summary, our systems become more integrated. We need new call taking and information sharing, including the use of new technologies. And with call-taking assistance, it allows us to do appropriate resource management and then support for the community and finally training for the larger community. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Augustine. Our next speaker is Linda Dodge from the Department of the DOT. And she's going to be talking to us about Next Generation 911, Rescue Me. And welcome, Linda.
Oh, I think I'll take my bracelet off. It's making some noise. Good morning. Thank you. Well, it's good to be here, and it's good to know that I have some people who are in the same, shall we say, experience level as I, because I have a tendency to gauge my entry into the EMS world with such terms as Omaha Orange, and the training manual was the Orange Book. So any of you who can relate to that? Makes me happy. So what we're going to talk about today, obviously, if I can get the clicker working correctly. Oops, it's a little slow. There we go. The overview, we're not going to talk a lot about the USDOT ITS program because, again, we could do a week on that. We are going to talk about traffic incident management, the mobility program, just a tiny bit, do a little update on NG911 and Rescue Me status and plans. Can you hear me okay? Okay. One thing, though, to start out with Rescue Me, and again, Dennis Leary's not here, but as we're moving toward a new suite of research with the ITS Joint Program Office, Intelligent Transportation Systems research, the funding is federal highway funding. We're located under the auspices of the Research and Innovative Technology Administration, and we are multimodal. We work with all the surface modes within the U.S. Department of Transportation. So our partners are Federal Highway, Federal Transit, Federal Railroad, MARAD, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, if I didn't say Federal Highway, and also, of course, RITA. So just to give you just a quick glimpse of where we are in the world of research right now, the vertical axis, we have the three major things that we're dealing with regard to what is predominantly wireless connected vehicle and vehicle connected to infrastructure type of work that we're doing. So the three areas being applications and, you know, the favorite term around the office right now, well, for probably the last 2 years, it's got an app for that. And it's kind of like the Verizon thing. We're kind of getting tired of hearing it, but it's still, I work with engineers. No offense, anybody. Technology and policy. And thank God for the engineers, because we certainly couldn't do it without them. But it's a big project. So the three components that I wanted to talk about with regard to what you're seeing here, obviously safety, mobility, and the environment. So those are our large suites of research, and as we work through those, the vertical areas, applications, technology, and policy, all have to be addressed. Rescue Me really actually is coming under mobility, and while it sounds safety, the safety under the ITIS Joint Program Office is predominantly hard safety. So we're talking vehicle-to-vehicle communication safety and structural safety. The mobility part, keeping everything moving, and hopefully by doing so and doing quick response and so on, as we are successful in that, we're improving safety as well. Environment, the ARIS program, and road weather applications. And all of these things really fit together and support one another, and we'll be leveraging research from all of those areas. Now, this is a really annoying slide, and I apologize. I could not get my two systems didn't talk to one another. So we'll move forward here. These are foundational research that had been done prior to Rescue Me. CAT ITS, we did a Seattle and a Salt Lake City project there, Mayday, of course, NG911, and signal preemption. And around the shop, it's being called, very affectionately, a SPAT, signal phasing and timing. So if you hear the term SPAT, we're trying not to use it because we're starting to overuse it, but bear with us. The responder dependent, and we're providing safety critical services, command and control the incident site, and initiating secondary response actions. Using the foundational work to move forward into Rescue Me, one of the concerns that, one of the concerns that we have is how are we going to capture the data and manage the program? Because in order to move forward, we have to know what data could or should exist. And which seems really strange, what do we limit it to? Because everybody wants everything. And I think we, in an EMS world, we had our run sheets, and then we became electronic, and then everybody wanted the reports. And all the data kept getting fed somewhere, and we never really got anything back. So we don't want to do that system again. We don't want to collect data just to collect it. So as we work forward, we're going to be working with you all, the interested parties, our stakeholders, to determine what's important to you, and then how do we keep it from being overwhelming, and how do we make it usable, and how do we archive it? So the dynamic mobility applications, if you remember the vertical and the horizontal area, the center one being the dynamic mobility applications. And I'm talking fast. I'm trying to get through the slide, so I need to slow down. Somebody give me a sign. I grew up on the East Coast. We started looking at bundles of applications. So what makes sense to put together? So how can we identify the potential benefits that can be realized by some of these bundles, and more specifically, the applications within those bundles? And then how can we prioritize them? And so we are looking at all the different options that might be available or required to support arterials, freeways. Again, we are transportation. So what is going on in all those areas, and how does that apply to all those areas of of research, and more specifically to the applications that we've identified as Rescue Me. And only then can we identify a smaller test environment and prepare a demonstration that really works. And then once it's tried and true, we will certainly move toward deployment, as tried and true as research can be, before it's a field operations test. Obviously, with vehicle-to-vehicle communications, it is what it says. It's vehicle-to-vehicle, vehicle-to-infrastructure. What is the infrastructure requirements that might be required? What kind of hotspots or what kind of additional telematic support technology might be required? Again, the application... Application bundles, and more specifically, we're getting into Rescue Me here. As you can see in the green box, we have the incident scene pre-arrival and staging guidance for emergency responders. We have incident scene work zone alerts for drivers. We have emergency communications and evacuation, and then we have Mayday Relay. Now, how did we get to those specific areas? There was a workshop in which a number of different disciplines were brought together: transportation, fire, EMS, law enforcement, a lot of federal agencies, a lot of private. And we brought this, basically it was a consensus process. It was a very loose consensus process. Then they brought it back to the Department of Transportation, and we worked with those areas to identify based on where the research was going, because we have an oversight group that's all of the administrations within DOT. So based on where they believe we need to be going, based on where our stakeholders believe we need to be going, and based on third-party manufacturers, automobile manufacturers, and integrators and so on, where do we need to be going? Where do we need to be looking? And so essentially, this was the group that we ended up with that appeared to go together for public safety at this point. Again, we talked about SPAT a few minutes ago. SPAT actually resides under the hard safety and also under mobility. So we're leveraging everything we can with regard to the other application research that's going on. And I have a tendency to be conservative with our research funds because, of course, being public safety, maybe we didn't get as much funding as some of the other applications that were sexier and bigger and brighter. So what we're doing is we're kind of watching the research progress, and we're grabbing everything we can and leveraging the other outcomes as they are moving forward. So anything we can do to leverage the research and the discoveries that are taking place in our partner research program, that's what we're doing. So it's still, Rescue Me is relatively new. We have a multimodal working group, and we have a couple of people in the audience. I think Keith Williams, if you would say hello. Keith is with Federal Highway Administration. Dave Bryson, Dave with National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And from our stakeholder group, we have Dia Gaynor. Dia, I don't know which hat you want to wear, but I'm going to use the TSAG hat, the Transportation Safety Advancement Group. That's an organization that the U.S. DOT funds to get feedback on a regular basis. TSAG is a multidisciplinary organization. They have fire, EMS, communications, towing. I don't know. It's a huge wealth of the industry that we can pull on, that we can go to them and say, so what do you think we need to be doing? What are we doing that could possibly conflict or threaten our public safety responders, and the very thing that we're trying to do to protect them could, in fact, accidentally, unintentionally, make their job harder rather than easier. This schematic is not intended in any way to promote a particular staging. It's just a staging diagram that we used to emphasize what we're talking about here. Obviously, Dr. Augustine was talking about situational awareness, making sure that responders are aware of their surroundings, making sure that you're aware of potential encroaching vehicles, whatever the danger may be. I've been standing beside of an ambulance and had the ambulance just simply slide away on the ice. And I'm sure that's happened to other people. Just slides away. So what happens if there's somebody downstream from that ambulance? Of course, then you always have the people who are driving too fast. So working with the telematics and ongoing research, we are trying to address these as work zones, temporary work zones. And so with the incident scene pre-arrival staging guidance for emergency responders and later pre-arrival for secondary responders, the application bundle will provide situational awareness for public safety responders while en route and can help to establish incident work zones that are safe for responders, travelers, and crash victims alike. And also, those of our public safety force that aren't going to that call have to either get by it or around it, and they have to do so safely and expeditiously. So how can we help to support that as well? The system can also be of great value to the decision-making process for the responders and dispatchers, and to achieve this, a range of data will be provided to responders through mobile devices to help support public safety responder vehicle routing, staging, secondary dispatch, and decision making. So Mayday Relay, again, one of the bundles, one of the apps within the bundle, pardon me. Am I getting close?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to speed up.
You're
now.
Over.
I'm over? Sorry.
Just a bit.
Okay, so these are pretty well self-explanatory. And again, we have one of these. Sorry. They line up with the intersect with the research. Again, here's an example of a work zone, a temporary work zone. Keep that in mind. This is not a roadway work zone. This is your public safety work zone. The vehicle-to-vehicle research will support this, as well as vehicle-to-infrastructure, as well as what we're doing with Rescue Me. Next Generation 911, it's completed. We're happy. The research was successful, and we held a What's Next workshop. Thanks to the TSAG, they put the workshop together, they sponsored the activities, and they helped us manage that. And you can find that result on the URL at the bottom of this page. Currently, NG911 is being managed out of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration EMS office under the National 911 office, which is a joint program office with NTIA. And then the emergency communications and evacuation. We all know how the difficulties we had during Hurricane Rita and so on. So we're working at how can we better provide dynamic routing and how can we better provide resources and real-time information, both to responders as well as the public. Summary, here's our work plan. And for more information, please go to www.its.dot.gov. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. If you're following the agenda, we have a little bit of a change, and Matt Crossman, down under Section 5, is going to talk about implementing new policies just before lunch. Matt?
We're beaming Matt in from Prince Edward Island, I think, is where he is in Canada. And we're just getting his sound check done for him. Matt, testing, 1, 2, 3. Matt?
Can you hear me, Nadine?
Loud and clear, Matt. Over to you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Dr. Levesque, and everybody there today. I'd just like to start by saying I'm sorry I wasn't able to be there in person today. The Transportation Research Board Summit is such an important day, and the information shared here today is really groundbreaking. I'll just give you a little bit of background from Prince Edward Island, Canada. I work for a company called MedEvie Emergency Medical Services, and we own and operate a few provincial services here in Canada, one being Prince Edward Island, another being New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and parts of Ontario. We also have a couple of communications company where we operate either the emergency medical dispatch and or 911 centers as well, and a few paramedical schools. We employ about 2,500 staff and have about 300 paramedic units. I'll just get you to change the next slide for me, if you
Thanks.
Could.
Thanks. Yeah, Matt, if you just ask us next for each slide change so that we'll change them for you.
Perfect. Thank you, Dr. Levick. Next. One of the amazing things which we had the experience to go through, which was a real life lesson for myself, was we implemented a policy within one of our, actually all of our operating companies, and it was called the Code 1 Speeding Policy. Next, please. The Speed 1 restriction policy was developed and implemented across all of our operating companies, and the reason and rationale behind it was part of our work that we had done with the EMS Safety Foundations, and specifically Dr. Levick since 2008. We were exposed to a huge new world of risk and really exposed to some of the risks that we have as an ambulance operator. When we look at all of our patient safety, clinical safety, occupational health and safety, there's all kinds of different risks that are involved when you operate a provincial service or even a small service. One of the biggest risks we found was we operate these 5-ton vehicles on a daily basis, and as you've heard from some of the great presentations earlier today, there's a lot of risk involved in that, in the way that they're constructed, in the survivability of the occupants inside. So we started to look at developing different policies and putting them in place that would not only keep our staff but and our patients, but also the public at safe. One of the main reasons that we implemented the policy was a lot of the studies and evidence had showed that the higher the speed, the greater risk not only to the people inside the vehicle, but also outside the vehicle. And we really looked at the amount of time saved in response to these emergencies and realized that the risk we were basically projecting onto our staff and the public and the patient wasn't worth the outcome. So next, please. We ended up putting a policy in place, and we really weren't prepared for the next reactions. We had done a great job at developing an education session for our staff and you know, really communicating well to the staff as to why we were doing this, implementing the policy, which was done really well. And we even did a really good job at bringing in our own stakeholders and really getting them familiar, I guess, as to why we did this. What we didn't do well was educate the public. Next, please. As you can see over the next few slides, there basically was a arbitration that took place. The local union here on Prince Edward Island grieved the policy. It went to an arbitrary board. Next, please. But the public outcry from the members of the public was really it was unbelievable at the support that the paramedics received from members of the public. When you think of it now in retrospect, it makes sense. You know, you're telling the public that we're going to respond slower to their loved ones when they're sick or injured. But what we didn't do a good job as a company was communicating the reasons why before the policy came out. We weren't prepared for the backlashing from the members of the public and also our own staff who really didn't understand or buy into the policy. Next, please. It even hit our other provinces, but also McLean's magazine, a national magazine. The story was picked up all across Canada and was really kind of the first time that a policy like this had been challenged. So there were a couple of things that worried us from a company perspective. If we had lost this arbitration, it takes away our ability to manage the company effectively and really look out for the safety of the employees, patients, and members of the public. One thing we were committed to as a company was to do what we believe was right. All the evidence had showed that it was really, you know, in the best interest of our paramedics, but not only them, the patients and the public. And although the union has a responsibility to the members of the association, the paramedics, we as a company have a bigger liability on our side to not only look out for our staff, which we value very highly, but also our patients and members of the public. Next, please. So what you'll see is more and more headlines. This went over for a period of about a year and a half from the time we implemented the policy until we actually went to arbitration. Next, please. One of the biggest things that we did was we went to the arbitration hearing very much prepared. We did all of our research. We brought together all the statistics that were in place. We also brought in some of the local experts or non-local in Dr. Levick's case. Next, please. And what we actually found after the arbitration, as you can see here, arbitration board refuses to put brakes on Island EMS speed policy. So the arbitrator actually ruled in our favor. They felt that we acted within cause and that there was no justification on the union side to deny a policy like this. It was a huge victory for our company and also the Medivie EMS group of companies, but not only for us, other companies around Canada, because once an arbitrator rules on a specific case, it then becomes kind of the standard to which all others are measured by. Next, please. So we were, you know, very successful in our own thing, but it really actually identified a few areas which we needed to work on in the future. When the arbitrator reviewed it, this is exactly what they had put in their findings. We accept that paramedics are highly motivated, highly skilled, and highly professional workers, and that they have a real insight into doing their job at the highest standards. However, this policy change was not imposed to benefit the employer except to diminish the possibility of accidents and consequently liability and other costs, or to somehow restrict the rights of the affected workers. The employer has determined legitimately, in our view, that there are 2% of patients will not be significantly affected by the change and that the change will improve the safety of all concerned. While ambulance operators have lost the discretion to drive at whatever speed they deem to be appropriate in circumstances, when considering the risk of injury to themselves or clients and the public, the balance, in our view, weighs in favor of the policy being found to be reasonable. Next, please. So, I guess one of the biggest things was we really were happy with the arbitration rule, but this really taught us a lesson. When we put a policy in place to look at, you know, some of the impacts that may actually happen, to get out in front of it and really educate our stakeholders, you know, really get the buy-in, make sure that education has been put out there to staff. And now it's something that we even attach to our policies. Any policies that go out in place, we actually attach the corresponding evidence that's based off of. And the paramedics and also members of the public have the ability to actually see for themselves the information that's out there. You know, when you look at this picture, this is an ambulance dated back quite a few years ago, but when you look closely in the passenger side, you'll see that the person's smoking. You know, it wasn't that long ago in a lot of our provinces and states where this was an acceptable practice for a paramedic. So although change sometimes can be very drastic, it just goes to show you that, you know, what we've always done in the past may not be what's best in the future. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Matt. We really appreciate you beaming in for that. We are going to take some questions now. Anyone in the audience? Matt, are you still online?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. Great. Yes, we have a question. Dr. Cooper?
Yes, perhaps I missed it, but this question is for Ms. Dodge. I didn't hear, don't think I heard a lot about advanced ambulance crash notification during your presentation, and I just wondered how that may or may not be integrated with the next generation 911 plans that your department is addressing at this point.
AACN is...
Great question.
I'm sorry?
Matt...
great question. Thanks very much.
Matt, are you answering? Because we have another person answering as well. Lynn, did you want to go first?
Great.
Hold on a minute.
AACN currently is under the... And I say currently, it originated and will continue to be under the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration for the management of it. But those technologies are being leveraged with Mayday Relay and any of the things that we're currently doing. None of that technology and none of those advancements will be lost. They'll all be considered. And, in fact, we've funded a lot of that research through NHTSA. So a lot of our funding goes with collaborative measures to a particular research project that is multimodal. Some actually goes mode specific, and in that case, we worked recently with the White House with Anish Chopra to stage, if you will, further opportunities for AACN research to be supported through the White House if they should make additional monies available.
Thank you, Linda. Matt, did you have a reply?
No, I believe Linda handled it very well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Rick.
This is for Dr. Augustine. You mentioned that everything's organized around counties, but in many of the larger city areas, cities are cut by more than one county. Have you seen any movement or any indication that going to full regional organizations like metropolitan planning organizations, that they're starting to get into this where you can have full integration around a much larger area?
I didn't mean to misapply that things are specifically revolving around counties. It's just notable that across many states, counties have been where the dispatch organizations and communication organizations have begun to move. There are very successful metro programs, and because so many metropolitan areas now do cut across counties, a metro approach, and I know that's in Toronto and Indianapolis, in Columbus, Ohio, and a number of other places, metro approaches are very advantageous to the community.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. We're fortunate we don't have to go out on the street in the rain looking for lunch. It